Okay.
This is Steve Maxner conducting an interview with Mr. Robert E. Garcia on the 26th of March, 2001 at approximately 10:20 Lubbock time. I am in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Garcia is in Pleasanton, California. Sir, why don't we go ahead and begin with a brief introduction to your early life, when and where you were born, where you grew up.
Okay, well, this is kind of a hard part for me. I grew up in a very dysfunctional family with multiple stepbrothers and a lot of it turned out very quickly, my first conscious memory, to be very violent, vulgar, and confusing. I had two older brothers that were the principal players in that vulgarity and violence, and it was kind of confusing for me to one day wake up and, so to speak, in terms of consciousness, and somebody, some stranger comes in and says, "I'm your real father," and that real father was an immigrant from the Philippines. And now and then during my early childhood, I would be kind of taken away once or twice a year by either he or his Filipino brothers to places in Stockton, California to spend a weekend with or a few days more than that at the farm labor camps in the Stockton, California area of San Joaquin Valley, where they would pick asparagus and things like that while I pretty much played fishing and gigging frogs. I was pretty much, our family was pretty much the only mixed race people in our whole neighborhood at that time. California has become very, very much multiracial at this point. But back then, before it became populated, before it became Silicon Valley, in that Silicon Valley area, we were pretty much an oddity, so to speak. The other kids were middle or upper middle class Caucasians, whereas we were lower middle class with a broken family, and we'd often hear several languages going on, one being Ilocano, which is a Filipino dialect, not Tagalog. And we'd hear that occasionally, and then we'd also hear my mother's side, which is Spanish. She grew up in Phoenix, Arizona. So there was a bit of, there were those things that were, put the whole family at odds with our Caucasian and wealthier neighbors. And I felt that. I felt that in grade school. And perhaps even more intensely as the school years went on, higher up, eighth grade, so on, even more in high school where things are kind of, can be a popularity contest. At the high school age, my mother had already broken up with left a stepfather and married a very bad person who turned the violence against my mother and turned the whole scene even uglier. This drunken scenes and wife abuse of my mother and things like that. And it got to the point where I ran away ended up living with a very upper middle class family, a white family who tried to make a difference with me, but there is huge culture class, a clash of temperaments. The family was the Keller family, and they became my legal guardians. H.B. is what I called the male figure, Harry B. Keller. I called him H.B. for short. He had a Ph.D. in physics. And his wife had a master's degree in mathematics. They were religious, Lutherans, and they said things like grace before dinner or whatever, whereas in my earlier times, we'd all just grab a plate of food and go watch the black and white TV and things like that. So in my high school years, there was not only the fact that I lived with a strange family, but also the cultural, racial things and the financial things in comparison to the upper middle class Caucasians that I was around, those that who were part of the rah-rah club or the cheerleader group or the jock group, or those that were probably destined to go to college, there is very much a feeling of alienation. There is no way that I was going to fit in with the jocks or those that are bound for MIT or the Naval Academy or Cal Poly, or even date some of the cheerleader girls. So there's big difference, big distancing there. And I felt it, tried to hide it. But that would pretty much characterize my feelings at that time, feelings of alienation and trying to cover up the fact that there was a lot of vulgarity and violence. When I talk about violence, I mean blood. Confusion. And I had an older brother. The two older brothers, one became a successful lawyer and writer, and his brother became a lifelong prisoner. And it turns out that the successful lawyer and writer is perhaps one of the biggest wannabes in the world. I'm not going to say his name, but he makes certain claims to having lived a life among the, shall we say, farm laborers when he was growing up, which is not true. And it's unfortunate that I did not see how much of a liar he was and just until I turned about 50 or so, happened to be surfing on the web. But it was good to find that out. I think he's made some claims about his Vietnam service that are pretty ridiculous. But on both his supposed life as a migrant farm worker and his claim of being with the grunts carrying a backpack radio, people are buying into it. But my own family, my wife, and wise people that I've consulted have told me just to let it go. Kind of unfortunate. Let's see where I'm heading with all this.
Well,
you're going to have to help me.
Yeah, let me ask you some questions real quick. Now, when you went and lived with this middle-class family where the father was a physicist and they were rather religious, and did that... What were the most important ways that helped you, or did it help you at all?
Well, okay, I've already talked about how I didn't really fit in.
Right.
I would say that Harry, H.B., did little things like talk to me like a human being and not try to control me and downgrade me like this wannabe older brother. He used to talk to me like a human being. You know, he took me on fishing trips, just he and I alone. And he took me to a track meet once. So he made time and showed the interest in me as a human being. So I guess that was very much an important part. When they decided to leave his work as a nuclear physicist, and they left me back, they arranged it so I could be back with my mother in a housing project, my mother and my little brother. And at that point, my mother had her latest husband had gone to prison, so she was available to be brought back into the housing project. Mm-hmm. But before HB and that family left, he did things. Maybe it was after they were gone. He sent me a letter saying that, telling me I was a winner. And this is completely opposite of what I had been told by that older brother all my life, which was to downgrade everything I do, make a sport out of humiliating me. Mm-hmm. But things like that letter saying that I was a winner, and a winner in the sense that I did not find intimacy in playing games with people, a winner in the sense that I did not treat people as objects. That was an important letter, and I'm remembering that fairly clearly. I'm sorry I lost it or whatever happened to it. And they always maintained contact with me for a long time. Mm-hmm. I would say at the point, the part that was disappointing in that relationship was that one thing is when I came back from Vietnam, they didn't even ask how was it. They said nothing. Mm-hmm. And after I must mention that they became professors in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. After that, they left our California area. Mm-hmm. After they left nuclear research field, they became professors. They decided after retiring from becoming professors in Minnesota to come back to California. And it was disappointing that they just went on and on about their own lives and not once really investigated how things had been in the years that followed, in the time in Vietnam or the years after it. I pointed it out to them, but they took that hard. But I was the one that took steps to smooth things over. So they had positive images. Mm-hmm. And the key thing was just to talk to me like a human being.
Do you still have contact with them?
Well, HB died almost a year ago today. After a prolonged period of dementia. But his wife, Lorraine, yes, we do have contact with her. Mm-hmm. And Will. And she does set aside money for my girl's college.
Wow.
And by the way, I'd like to mention that I became father late. Mm-hmm. At about age 40, my girl turns 11 on March 29th, and that happens to coincide with the date of the last troops getting out of Vietnam, mm-hmm. American troops, mm-hmm. and it coincides with the night of HB's death.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about with regard to that period of your life?
Well, I'd like to say that at this point, I take a little bit of pride in the fact that out of my whole high school, that I don't mind that I didn't go to Cal Poly or Naval Academy. And of all the people in that group, I'm probably very small. I'm part of a small number that went to Vietnam in a direct combat support field. I was in an Army riverboat. I take a little bit of pride in that, and the fact that I did so coming from my dysfunctional, violent family, confusing times in the family and in the 60s, personal confusion, and I did so standing up. And though others might have in my school might have achieved more financially, by some less, I can I can say that I think I carry a little bit of distinction.
Mm-hmm.
And if I should give my girl these transcripts, I'd like her to see that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's about it.
Yes, sir. When you, let's see, you turned 20 when you volunteered, is that correct?
Yes, you're going to have to speak up a little louder.
Sorry about that. And what year was that when you volunteered to go into the Army?
It was 1969.
Okay. How much about the Vietnam War had you heard about?
Well, yeah, okay. During high school, I think little flashes of stories on an old black and white TV would come on. We'd see little articles in the newspaper, maybe some minor discussions in class about primarily protesters. And it was just enough, and those themes were graphic enough, and the discussions about them were just enough to disrupt my little boy, play army out in the fields mindset. I think being a kid of post-World War II, in the post-World War II era with all the World War II propaganda movies and TV series, combat, Periscope and things like that that you saw constantly, even in those propaganda cartoons. I think it had been pretty much an established mindset that you're going to go to war or into the military someday, and you can play army for real. But those protests were enough to cause a little bit of hesitancy, perhaps more than a little bit. You know, when you live in the Bay Area and you hear about riots going on at UC Berkeley, which is only about 38 miles or 35 miles away, and you hear about in other campuses, and you see adults with carrying signs around the Capitol, and you have some minor discussions in high school, and that kind of makes you back down from the ideal of being a soldier, sailor, air forceman, or Marine. So I was aware of that. So I would say that had it not been for the demonstrations, and if it only had been totally positive imagery about the military involvement, I probably would have enlisted right out of high school. But since I had heard about protests and riots, and maybe some casualty figures, I didn't go in right away. I spent about a year measured in terms of quarters, college quarters at Winona State College in Winona, Minnesota. And that 1 year, full academic year, however, was broken up into little parcels of, well, I had little intermissions of hitchhiking, like, which was fairly common during the 60s. And some periods of work, hitchhiked to New Orleans, back to California, worked a while in Arizona. Was on my way once back to Winona State College. And set the hell with it and got a ride with a truck driver to Boston. And ended back up in, after that little tour was over, ended back up in Minnesota. So that's why I wasn't a 17 or 18 year old service person. I'd spent about a full year, a little longer, doing the college thing and hitchhiking thing, trying to get a sense of direction. I already knew that I didn't like college. And that's why the hitchhiking interludes.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that in Winona State, before I finally decided to go into the military in 1969, I had met a person from the Midwest who had gotten a draft notice. He was already done with his bachelor's degree. His name was Chuck. Oops, still there?
Mm-hmm, yes, sir.
Ooh, hit a button.
Mm-hmm.
And we became friends, and I decided to go in with him.
Mm-hmm.
Because I really didn't want to continue with college, and I think that despite all the TV broadcasts on protests and casualty figures, that the military was always waiting for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that I took note from something that older half-brother said was, let me backtrack a little bit here.
Okay.
Let's keep Chuck, my friend from Winona State, in mind. I had seen the movie Sand Pebbles
mm-hmm.
with Steve McQueen and Candice Bergen about four or five times. I just loved it. I kind of wanted to be that, go up rivers and stuff, like Steve McQueen. The movie Sand Pebbles has to do with the naval river operations, I believe in the Yangtze River in the 1930s, when the Americans had naval river boats to protect their business and various church interests and on the Yangtze River. I saw the movie a lot, fell in love with it, decided that's what I wanted to do. But since my half-brother came back and said, listen, you know, think about doing 4 years of high school all over again, but doing it in the military. You know, I thought about that, and I said, okay, that is something to keep in mind, that 4 years in high school felt like eternity. So my conversations with Chuck, you know, he dragged me to the recruiter, I think it was, and the recruiter mentioned volunteering for the draft. 2 years, and that's it. So I did that with Chuck, and I did sign up for... I found out by accident or serendipity or something, but just by looking in some office, I picked up the magazine, and there was an article on the Army's river boats, or boats, whatever it was. And so I must have talked to the recruiter about that, and I signed up for it, and after tail end of basic, which I took at Fort Bragg, North Carolina in 69, and it turns out that I got my watercraft operator AIT. So that's 1969, and I was 20. And where do we go from here?
Well, I'm curious, when you were going to school, mm-hmm. what didn't you like about college?
Well, I don't think I've ever really liked college or school. I think I've always been kind of a free spirit inside, free thinker, and not much for any kind of regimentation in church, formal school, things like that, or even expectations from friends. Does that make any sense?
Sure.
I just kind of a free person.
Mm-hmm.
It was that, the formalities of school, mm-hmm. plus being at a state college in Minnesota, which was far from California.
Mm-hmm.
There seemed to be the same kind of cliques as there were in high school. I just didn't feel like I fit in with that. They had dormitories and alpha, you know, the what do they call those, sorority fraternity clubs and all that. And it's just, I guess I took that feeling of alienation from my growing up time and put it at the college level in the Midwest, and it just, I felt a little bit more isolated among the Midwesterners in their college. Mm-hmm. I must say that I didn't feel like it was very academically challenging. Disappointing, really, in certain areas. Like I took a political science class, and I really don't think they talked about structures of government or the Constitution, the basis for it. It's just more like a English class where you just became a bit philosophical. I didn't learn about politics or government. Mm-hmm. Took a human anatomy class for biology. And I thought these things were going to be tough. That really didn't turn out to be that tough. So that's pretty much it.
Mm-hmm. Was there a particular subject that you did enjoy, or subjects that you enjoyed?
Well, let me say this. In high school, I kind of got an interest in electronics because some earlier year, some kid showed me the inside of a transistor radio, and I just was fascinated by these little parts. I took some high school electronics, but I really did not have the algebra or the math necessary for it. To do good at it when it came time to work out the formulas. And nobody told us that we had to have a math prerequisite. Mm-hmm. So I kind of winged it through by borrowing test answers from my friends. Mm-hmm. So I'll get to the variations in college majors in a second. Mm-hmm. That older brother had enough influence in me that I went on to state I became an English major because that was his interest. After Vietnam, I took up some electronics courses in community college at night, things like that, where I did make up on the math deficiency. Took me a little extra time and concentration, but I went far beyond the basic math that I thought I was stuck at. Things like trigonometry, probability, and statistics. And it was nice to learn the hard way that I was capable of doing that kind of thing. I switched majors later on. I did finally graduate. I quit a full-time job and finished my bachelor's degree. I don't know if that was a smart thing to do, but when I was about 30, I ended up as an art major. The studio portions of the state college art department was disappointing. Not in any way probably comparable to an art, strictly art academy. But you know, I couldn't afford that kind of thing. But another part of the art major is our history. And I memorized hundreds of pieces of art, sculpture, paintings, who they were by, what they meant. I learned things about Hindu temples and could identify at that time in European cathedrals. I loved art history. And I actually learned to enjoy working out math problems when I was an electronics major. So there were some things that I really did enjoy about some classes, not all classes, in college in the various majors. So.
Okay.
Yeah, it was like the military. There was some mixed feelings. Mm-hmm. Things I liked, things I didn't like.
Now, were you athletic at all? Did you like to play, especially earlier, either in high school or in your first 1 year in Minnesota? Did you enjoy particular sports?
Well, when I was a kid, I enjoyed baseball, Little League, fastball. And I wished I would have continued with that in high school. But since I was, and this is really embarrassing to admit here, but since at that time I was under pretty much trying to be my older brother's clone, I went into his sports, which I was not physically, older half-brother's clone, physically structured for, like football and shot put. Had his influence not been there, I think I would have stuck it out with playing high school baseball. College, no, there wasn't any sports there. But then my college spanned about a 10-year period where I worked during the day and went to school at night or weekends, or worked at night and commuted to school during the day. And in that 10-year period, I got to the sports that I liked, that I was natural with. You understand, I started breaking away. I guess maybe Vietnam or prior to it, ended up breaking away from that older half-brother's domination. I ended up going into skin diving and scuba diving. I did that for many years off the coast of California. I got my basic and advanced certification in scuba. And I had a best friend who was my diver friend. He was a Hawaiian-American, Mo Maka'iwi. So I enjoyed that kind of non-team sport, kind of thrill thing, being underwater, having a contraption on my back. So that was my principal in the 10-year gap between starting college and finishing college. At the age of 30, I did have a sport that I liked, and that was scuba diving, skin diving.
Now, did you ever run into any strange or interesting or dangerous wildlife during your scuba diving, skin diving activities?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I don't think it was really... Well, the whole thing was, for a while, was very interesting. I remember my first deep dive off coast of California. You get 15, 20 feet visibility, and that's pretty much it.
Mm-hmm.
My first deep dive, I just remember going deeper and deeper, just having a certain anxiety. When am I going to see something?
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of feeling lost and anxious about seeing something earthly.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, it became pretty natural. And I'd just like to say that it's kind of odd that I should become a natural diver, because the older half-brother that I grew up with used to do his best to drown me in the public high school swimming pool. You know, he spent a lifetime in jail and prisons, but he started out by being sadistic with me.
Mm-hmm.
He'd plunge me underwater and just hold me there until I could hardly breathe, die for air, and he'd let me up and start the whole process, plunge me under. At that age, the difference in strength and age and courage is so much more amplified, I think,
mm-hmm.
for a younger kid.
Mm-hmm.
So even though I had that background of being damn near drowned by the head, I just naturally had this fascination with being underwater.
Mm-hmm.
I used to watch Sea Hunt with that Aqualung diver, whatever his name is. Bridges, Lloyd Bridges.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to be fascinated by underwater, seeing So the opportunity presented itself where the job my employer had, a skin and scuba diving club. This is after Vietnam.
Mm.
And I just got into it, and I just, except for a few moments of anxiety, just took to it quite naturally and did it for years.
Okay.
I did see some fish while I was spearfishing that they're so big, so surprisingly big and ugly, I wouldn't dare try to spear them. But I enjoyed it. The earlier period of being damn near drowned just didn't stand my way.
Mm-hmm.
I went on night dives. Night dives, the initial one was a little bit scary, but it was fun. I loved it. Peaceful.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever run into any sharks or barracuda?
No, just a small shark.
Mm-hmm.
No big deal. They don't have barracuda off the coast of California.
Oh, there's not?
No.
Oh, okay.
I did get slammed on the beach once, and that about still have calcium deposits where I got hurt. And my back still goes out now and then.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of made it worse when I made a few parachute jumps. I like intense things.
Mm-hmm. okay.
But I made sure, though, I just like to say that given my sadistic half brother's treatment in the pool, that when it came time to teach my girl how to get around in the water, she was 3 years old when I started her doing underwater. I just kind of gently talked her into trusting me, tell her what's going to happen next. Now I'm going to do this for a second, I want you to do that with your breath. So I had the pleasure of gently teaching my girl to trust me and to go underwater.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a little swimming frog now.
Okay.
I'm not sure I want her to be putting on a tank.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and talk about your first introduction to the military.
Okay.
You said that you did your basic training at Fort Bragg. What was it? What was your introduction like when you arrived at Bragg?
Well, first thing I remember, I guess, is some kind of federal building in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where all of the four branches, I think, assembled, took their oaths, and I guess they got their physicals there. And how it was administratively handled and give us tickets to fly and how we got to what airport, I can't recall. But I do recall being on the bus. Going through Fayetteville, North Carolina, which is where Fort Bragg is. And clearly it was middle of the night, I think. And the old bars or honky-tonks were pretty well lit up. And I see to my left a bunch of GIs that already made it. You know, they had been through the process, and they were in their khaki pants or khaki shirts, going in and out of bars. Can't recall very much talking among us. A bunch of strangers on that bus going through Fayetteville. That's about all of Fayetteville I saw. The next thing I can think I can remember is arriving at some little building and a bunch of these just two soldiers. I hear their voices and they start yelling at us. We scrambled off the bus. And it was kind of a rude awakening that these shiny helmets aren't helmet liners. They're screaming things like, "Don't look back! Don't look! Who told you to look around?" And I think it was at that moment. I don't know if they still do that, but at that moment, I really deeply regretted volunteering for the draft. And I really had big second thoughts, and it dawned on me that you're in a different still now, and there ain't getting out.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't like dropping out of Winona State College and going hitchhiking. So that's pretty much my introduction.
What was the training like?
Training of basic?
Mm-hmm.
Actually, looking back on it, I consider it the best part of the Army. Oops, and that goes again.
Mm-hmm.
The drill instructors, after we got out of our, what they call it, reception company, which is about a few days at getting haircuts and all that, and being taught basic formations and marching. All the drill instructors, we got taken to our company area where we're going to be for a few months. They initially did the yelling, the classic Gomer Pyle Marine Corps thing, two DIs jump yelling one person, but I quickly learned to get around that. When they have us in front and lean position, they're yelling at one person, you drop a knee down. And all that DI screaming and all that kind of thing that they show on the TVs and part of the great myth, that pretty much subsided.
Mm-hmm.
From that point, after the initial introduction, shocks, it's pretty much routine. Clean your bunk, assemble outside, standard formation, front and lean position, which is push-ups, roll call, clean up your barracks, and get ready for a meal. And when I say get ready for a meal, it's not like casually going to your college cafeteria and having picking for something. You have to do strict things, like back then at Bragg, they would have you line up and do push-ups. They'd have this almost like a mini obstacle course before you even got to the old mess hall. They'd have to do chin-ups or push-ups or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
It'd have to be strictly military. And in groups of five or so at a time for a meal. And so it's part of the preparation of the day. And if I say preparation and things got routine, things were very military. You had to do the push-ups before a meal. When you got into the meal area, it wasn't just a casual sit down and talk and chatter. Generally, from what I remember, they have some DIs in there screaming at them for somebody called a DRO. I think it meant dining room orderly.
Mm-hmm.
He was a guy that was designated to run around doing errands. But the way they bellowed his name, I prayed to God that I would never be a DRO. So when we were talking about how was basic training, it's hard to say. I mean, it was strictly military, but it wasn't any kind of somebody getting some DI hitting you on the side of the head with a rifle, but
mm-hmm.
if people are afraid to have that image of basic or boot, I think they're wrong. DIs were professionals. My DI's name was Bobby Davidson. He was a black guy. He wasn't big. He had the patch, combat patch of the 25th Infantry on his shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't go out of his way to become your buddy or anything. He followed what he said. But he didn't scream and spit at you and knock you on the side of the head. But you sure wouldn't do anything to upset him. And I really had to respect respect for him because, well, he was a professional. When we did things like going out to, with our M14s, to the rifle range, we didn't walk, we marched, and we marched through sugar sand, is what they call it in North Carolina. And contrary to the image that the Army doesn't take people with flat feet, I had, my feet are board flat. I had a tough time marching, keeping up.
Mm-hmm.
Bobby Davidson would always take our platoon and lead the company. And he would have us out in the lead whenever he could, which made it tough for my little flat feet to keep up. That's the way he was. He didn't need to yell at us. And we didn't disrespect him. I'd always registered in me that he used to grimace now and then, move his leg around as if he was in pain. Well, it turns out that he was shot in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So he wasn't any kind of sergeant that had just gone to NCO school and DI school and was a make-believe NCO. The guy had Purple Heart. You know, he didn't rub that status in our face. And if anything, he had, I gather from a few things that he did or said to us, that he had the whole basic training routine perspective. And I think the one thing that really made me understand that he had that things in perspective is that when it came to this thing called the obstacle course or confidence course,
mm-hmm.
that classic image of people climbing ropes and jumping over hurdles, you know, that you see on TV.
Mm-hmm.
He told us guys, he just looked at it with disdain and said, you guys want to go do that? Go ahead. And I thought, what? We get a choice? What happened to TV, you know? The movies. So I really respected him.
Mm-hmm.
Some GI said that, well, at Fort Bragg, they have these old barracks. World War II barracks. I understand they're called the old division mm-hmm. barracks. They're pretty miserable things. There's no latrines, stalls, and the booths, which is very embarrassing. Came time for potty time. But I think, if I recall correctly, he had his own room up there in the old barracks, second floor. One of the other GIs said he had a conversation with him in that room. He says, you know, Bobby's crazy. Start talking about Vietnam and how his lieutenant screwed up. I never took Bobby that way. Not at all. I mean, people toss around that idea of somebody being crazy too loosely. So, I had respect for all the DIs.
Mm-hmm.
The captain, I can't say that. The company commander, I can't say that. That. Some once or twice come out. Second lieutenant, or whatever it was, I only saw him a few times as well.
Mm-hmm.
People that managed us up front in person were the DIs, the NCOs.
Mm-hmm.
The officers made 2-3 appearances, and that's it. And I hate to say this, but that's about the level of involvement that I found them throughout my Army time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's unfortunate.
Now, were any of the other DIs Vietnam veterans as well?
Let's see. Yes, I think so. I think about half of them were.
Mm-hmm. How did they incorporate that experience into training, or did they? You know, did they say, hey, this will save your life, or hey, that'll get you killed, that type of thing, if, when you get to Vietnam?
I don't think they did.
Okay.
I think they were, probably had a program where they were given, and they followed it according to schedule.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but in the course of
that. In fact, my chief DI, you know, I'm sure that half of them were Vietnam veterans and combat infantry type. I can recall seeing the combat infantry badge. They didn't say you're going to, you know, don't aim that, don't get serious about the M14 when you get to Vietnam. You're going to be given the M16 or other junk. The course was with the M14. We learned how to zero our M14 and fire it at distances.
Mm-hmm.
We learned how, you know, everything we did was with the M14 and nothing with the M16, which was used pretty much exclusively in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't get introduced to the M16 until you got to Vietnam?
Well, no. After, basic was exclusive. It was exclusively M14.
Okay.
Even there was this little portion of weapons firing that they called quick fire. It's where, I think they learned it from Vietnam. It's where you don't take time to do the classic, you know, take a deep breath, breathe regularly, hold the breath, squeeze.
Mm-hmm.
It was more of something that they acquired from Vietnam, which you shot instinctively. You just raised it to a certain level, and you did a certain thing, and you squeezed.
Mm-hmm.
They called it quick kill. And that's about the only thing that I think that was carryover from experiences in Vietnam. All the rest of it, I think, was training for some kind of European engagement with the Russians.
Okay. And what was the most difficult thing about basic training for you, personally?
Other than the initial shocks of you know, being screamed at in like, the reception center and all that, I would say it wasn't all that difficult physically.
Mm-hmm.
And I've already characterized the treatment of DIs as not fitting in with the, you know, the movie scenes of being yelled at and screamed at, punched upside the head. I would say that the most difficult thing was getting along with strangers.
Mm-hmm.
While I say that, I must say that perhaps my time with that strange family in my teenage years is kind of coincided with that.
Mm-hmm.
At some point in life, you're going to be stuck with strangers.
Mm-hmm.
So that early family, strange family thing is not really that unusual. I would say that also, the physical side, I can't dismiss that there were problems there. I had problems with my flat feet.
Mm-hmm.
My feet just could not march through the sugar sand of North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me realize that there's a basis for that, what you used to hear, the Army doesn't take people with flat feet. Well, I guess they did in the late 60s.
Yes, sir.
But there, I think there's good reason for it.
Mm-hmm.
I just could not keep up. And my DI even had me run ahead of the group with a fat boy. So physically, the range marches were tough for me.
Mm-hmm.
Not because I was out of shape, but that's because my anatomically, my feet were just not designed for it.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was the ethnic makeup of your platoon, your basic training platoon?
I went in from Northfield, Minnesota. And I think all of us geographically speaking, from a certain point in the continental U.S., went to places on the East Coast or other basic places. And other people went to places like Fort Bragg or Fort Ord on the West Coast. So I ended up with a mix of Midwesterners, which were primarily white, and Southerners, I think, a few of those were primarily white, and a number of black guys. They could have been East Coasters or Southerners, I'm not quite sure. I do remember one guy came from Harlem. So I'd say, and by the way, I'd say that I did not see one Chinese, Japanese American. There was one pure Filipino group. I'm multiracial Mexican, Chicano Filipino. There was one other pure Asian Filipino. And I did relook through my basic training album. There's not one Chinese American, not one Japanese American, all group. And I think that's kind of odd. But it was pretty much evenly mixed.
Okay.
And I think we got along pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, however, that the blacks, the African Americans, the blacks would try to see what they could get by with in terms of intimidating the white guys. And they tried to do it on this one Minnesota farm boy. And it's not they that tried it. This one big black guy, not tall big, but stocky, tried to pick on this one white boy from Minnesota, farm boy. And the farm boy just said, okay, you know, go. And at that point, the black guy just backed down. So there wasn't any racial tension in basic, other than I think those inner city black guys would probably do their inner city thing, see if they could get by with it. But if challenged, they would, you know, knock it off. People got along pretty good.
Okay.
Now, I'd like to say, though, that while we're on that issue, I do have a picture of a black guy. I think it's the same guy. Yeah, it is the same guy, because he mentioned the inner city guys, black guy's name. There's a picture of him, a little bulky, with a black DI in front of him, talking to him. Not nose to nose, but pretty close. Not screaming with eyes bulging out. And the black guy has his eyes lowered a little bit. So the DIs, black DIs, did not treat the black soldiers any better or worse than anybody else. That same soldier in basic who had his eyes lowered, I ran across him twice in Vietnam. And it's odd that there's that image of him being passive or docile. And when I saw him, he was, first time, he was driving by in a truck with a bunch of, in 71 in Vietnam. And he noticed me. And he had then, at that point, he had his, he raised his arm in Black Power salute. And the second time, second and last time I saw him, he mentioned that this inner city guy was killed. And another inner city, I don't know if he was inner city, this guy by the name of Ivy, had a leg blown off or something like that. Well, I don't know about the guy with the leg blown off. But I looked up this other guy's name, Holmes, his last name. And he was not on the registry for people killed. So, points there is this black guy made a big transition from being a docile trainee to somebody who I'd passed by a couple years later with his black power salute. And it also speaks to the fact that, you know, rumors, somebody got killed when they in fact didn't.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, this will end the interview with Bo Garcia on the 26th of March. Okay, let's start over. Sir, why don't you go ahead and discuss your AIT training in Virginia?
Okay, I went to from Fort Bragg to, and I got the MOS that I signed up for, a watercraft operator. I'd like to say that I mentioned the basic was the best part. Well, transitioning into and beyond basic was, well, into AIT was the bitter part.
Okay.
I say that because the bitterness started out with being held too long without any explanation, without any talks or any information being passed on to us when we were just kind of warehoused at a reception, a holding company, mm-hmm. I think is what they called it.
Mm-hmm.
That's where they pretty much left us to hang around for too long for AIT.
Okay.
I'd say that a bit of bitterness came out there because they just told us nothing. Moving on to AIT, and this is the part that might as well just make this a quick one because it started out with basic seamanship and then went on to watercraft operator. And it was basically useless and not very fun compared to basic. The only thing that I found exciting, strenuous, maybe useful was the firefighting and water survival training. Firefighting, the parts of it were kind of scary, and the water survival was a little bit strenuous and interesting. But outside of that was just, forget it, they should have just shipped us on out to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And I finished my AIT, but ended up in some administrative clerical job for too long, perhaps about a year.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't fit. Although I made a few good friends, it was really a pointless time, and pointless to the point where I ended up volunteering for Vietnam, not out of patriotism, not out of a sense of adventure, but just to get out of Fort Eustis.
Okay.
And it just so happens that a fairly recent friend at work, he's a Filipino guy, American, we've been talking. And because he's a Vietnam veteran and because he's a Filipino, I've been goofing around, kind of disrupting his little accountant world. And we've been pretty good friends. And he mentioned that even though, you know, he went to basic and AIT, artillery, he found the artillery thing not too good. And then he went to jump school at Fort Bragg, I think it was, 82nd Airborne. He went to jump school, and he ended up at Fort Bragg.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he volunteered for the same reason, and that was out of boredom.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of that kind of shook up my image of the 82nd Airborne people. I thought, well, nothing but fun, excitement. But the way he briefly described it was he was bored.
Hmm.
And even a crewmate on my riverboat got in touch with me about a year ago. He said that he volunteered for Europe first to get out of Fort Lewis. and then he volunteered, and he didn't get that, but he made sure that he got Vietnam. So there's a group of us that did that, just volunteered, found AIT not too good, and volunteered to get out of stateside duty.
Now, how many people were in your AIT class?
I don't know. I'd say about 20.
Okay. And what kind of boats did you guys train on?
We really didn't do much boat training.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think they had what they call LCMs.
Okay.
They had a brief session on steering them
mm-hmm.
in some harbor over in Fort Eustis, Virginia. And then one night they had a long trip up the James River,
mm-hmm.
and that was just a few hours. And that was pretty much it. All the other training was classroom training, a little bit of navigation, a little bit of how to weave these things they call bumpers, you know, the things, cushions to keep boats from getting damaged against piers,
mm-hmm.
fenders, I think they call them. And the firefighting, I said, was good.
Mm-hmm.
How to survive in smoke and how to put out a big fire. It's a thing called Z-Pit, where it's a diesel fuel-filled pit that they ignite.
Mm-hmm.
And it surprised me because I thought you were supposed to stand back and spray, but they put you on a crew manning the hose.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of standing back, you walk into the flame by first putting the nozzle on a fog, and you walk very close into it, and then you spray the base. I heard that other people had dropped and ran. And to tell you the truth, that's exactly what I felt like doing.
Mm-hmm.
But I did it exactly as instructed, out of fear,
mm-hmm.
rather than, you know, being a good student. So that was exciting. And then there's the navigation, classroom training, one boat trip, smoke survival in these permanently built rooms.
Mm-hmm.
Show you how to weave around close to the ground when there, you know, there's smoke above you,
mm-hmm.
and drag somebody out. That's about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty boring.
Now, what size boats were these that you did? What little training you did you receive on boats? What size are they?
They were smaller than the one that I eventually ended up in.
Mm-hmm.
They called them landing craft medium or something
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was about it. There really wasn't much boat training. And there was absolutely no weapon training. And let me just skip around here and weave that in.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I reported to the actual boat in Vietnam, it was a much larger boat, and it was loaded with weaponry.
Mm-hmm.
350 cals, 350 caliber machine guns. And there was a paratrooper that had to show me how to disassemble and assemble mine. I guess I pretty much became the arms person for 50 calibers.
Okay.
So that was my first introduction to 50 caliber.
It was in country in Vietnam.
In country in Vietnam, and then there's these other little routines they had of going to places like the Qua Viet River, which was basically my first trip, and for a number of months after that were a lot of trips down the Qua Viet in Vietnam. The Qua Viet River led to a ammo dump by a village called Dong Ha.
Mm-hmm.
It's where we let all our loads of artillery rounds or M16 rounds off. And the Qua Viet is about 15 miles from the DMZ. And and they would station a couple people on the 50 calibers, and two people, they'd rotate the two people up front on the bow, with M16s, flak jackets, steel pots on to shoot at things like water mines.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole thing was preceded or led by minesweepers that were manned by Vietnamese crews. Well, AIT didn't even come close to informing us that that kind of thing would take place.
Mm-hmm. Were any of your AIT instructors Vietnam veterans?
Not that I'm aware of. I think they wore civilian clothes.
Mm-hmm.
They might have been retired Navy.
Hmm.
So if any of them were active duty in civilian clothes, I have no idea whether they went to Vietnam or not. I don't know.
Okay.
I eventually talked to somebody who was on the riverboats in the Mekong, and even up north, who said that he eventually became an NCO career person and he eventually became an instructor there.
Mm-hmm.
And he mentioned that he had gotten into a number of arguments with the regular instructors and pointing out that it was basically a farce.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Had the training been realistic, had they told us that you're going to lose a lot of sleep,
mm-hmm.
you're not going to have any privacy, you're not going to have any time or space away from each other, you're going to be in a constant routine of doing this up the coast of South Vietnam and down the rivers and back and forth and back and forth, maybe I would have hesitated quite a bit to volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
So it was quite a shock to see what the life of a riverboat crewman, Army crewman, really was like,
mm-hmm.
since I wasn't prepared for it.
Sure. Okay.
And I think AIT should do that, prepare
mm-hmm.
you.
Sure. The training, the boat training that you do receive, how fast did those boats move, approximately, and how long are those boats that you trained on?
Like I said, the training on the boats was very, very, very little.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how long they were. 40 feet.
Okay.
And then the one trip we took down the James River at night,
okay.
We pretty much stayed in the engine room. I remember a couple of us just staying in there with the loud, noisy engines.
Mm-hmm.
So what value that had, I don't know.
Yeah.
None.
Hmm. Did they train you on maintenance for the boat?
No. I would imagine that there was a separate MOS
mm-hmm.
that trained the engine mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
But for the crewman types, no, they didn't. They didn't train us on maintenance, such as scraping paint that's been rusted off by seawater.
Mm-hmm.
How to treat that with lead-based paint and all that.
Mm-hmm.
That even something as basic as that they didn't cover.
Hmm.
At least I can't remember any of that.
Yeah. Well, I am curious. You mentioned earlier that one of the reasons you went in the military, one of the things you knew you wanted to do was be on boats, and that was predicated on the movie Sand Pebbles.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you choose the Army and not the Navy?
Well, like I said previously, I had talked to that half-brother who had gotten back from Vietnam, and I think he was actually a tactical microwave systems repair specialist, but he makes himself out to be an RTO. He said, think again about it, you know. Go 4 years in the Navy, it's like doing 4 years in high school all over. Well, I guess I just didn't want the 4 years. I was just playing it safe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in case I was unhappy.
The Navy didn't have a two-year program?
No, they didn't. 4 years.
Okay. Good enough. Well, when you finally got your orders for Vietnam, what did you think?
Well, I was just desperate to get out of Fort Eustis, Virginia.
Okay.
I guess if I were to characterize my feeling about what would happen, if that's part of the question, I guess I intuitively knew that I would be exposed to some danger, but not like the grunts. I suppose I knew that I would be kind of in the war, kind of not in. If that makes any sense. I'm saying that I knew I'd come back. It was a weight that I knew I'd have adventure and some exposure to danger, but fairly sure that I'd be okay in 71. But the rest of it, as far as what all the details were, the routines and the tight quarters and being around people that you couldn't get away with, and being around a lot of sometimes it turned pretty hostile, to the point where one person wanted to talk the rest of us into committing mutiny and hiring people to murder our warrant officer several times, constantly harassing each other. Those kinds of details I was not aware of in the sleep deprivation.
Well, why don't we go ahead and discuss quickly your trip over. And how did you travel to Vietnam? What was it like? And what was it like when you got off the aircraft or off the boat?
Okay, I guess, I stopped and saw that family from Minnesota who had been my legal guardians at one point. Didn't stay there long. Then I flew back to the Bay Area where I was supposed to go to Oakland Army Depot. Some call it Oakland Army Base, but I consider it a depot. I see. What I remember there is, well, that's another point of bitterness. Back to Fort Eustis, they did give us a little tiny bit of Vietnam indoctrination, a little brief indoctrination to the M16, and a film about Vietnam, try to be abstinent over there. You're not going to die. You could get, venereal disease. And a film clip of some soldiers trying to escape from an APC, armored personnel carrier. And it's kind of shocking because I knew that they wouldn't live, from what I remember of the film. Then they put us on this little... they put us on trucks and they put, as part of the indoctrination, and they tried to get us to disembark from the truck properly, as if there was an ambush taking place. They did some yelling and all that kind of stuff. If that had some value for us, I have no idea. I don't think so. So there was that little bit of indoctrination, I said good farewell to my friend Ernie Chasen, who stayed behind in his little clerical job. Ernie was an interesting guy. He was French-Canadian, but American, and he was pretty good at the guitar. He was my friend for a while, and he ended up in the Army because he had a choice, jail or Army. And he went Army.
Okay.
and he had an extra year beyond me. So I just said goodbye to Ernie, and he didn't say much. Just said, keep your head low.
Mm-hmm.
So I did my little buys, indoctrination, trip to the Legal Guardians in Minnesota, and reported to Oakland Army Depot, where they pretty much warehoused us. Didn't talk to us, didn't tell us how long we're going to be there, cheer us up or anything. They just put us in these old warehouses with a whole bunch of strangers mingling around, doing formations a couple times a day, I guess to find out who got called up for their flight. For the rest of us, it was just pretty much do nothing. And the bitterness started to creep in there. And it even got to the point where, you have a choice of, okay, you people that are not on the manifest, KP. And sometimes I would want at least one occasion I gave blood instead of doing KP. I was fortunate enough, though, that I had my dysfunctional family around. So at night, a couple of times, I was able to go to my mother's house or go to my half-brother's house where, to get away from the Oakland Army Depot, because I was dying over there at night looking out of the hills of the people who were at home in the city of Oakland, and just wishing that I was home too, and not stuck and warehoused at the Oakland Army Depot.
Mm-hmm. How long did you stay there?
I really don't know. I just seemed like it kept going on and on.
Mm-hmm.
All I know is that it's just a bunch of do-nothing stuff, hanging around, and at night just wishing you could be home in one of those comfortable houses on the hills of Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
Except for a few times that I went home to spend time with my mother or my half-brother. My half-brother and his girlfriend would take me out, real life. And my mother, I put this down, my mother really pissed me off once when she brought home some guy who was about the same age as me from a bar. And I know I was broadcasting, I'm about to kick your butt, same age as me guy. And because after I got back from a trip from the bathroom, the guy was gone. So I would say that all of this adds up to not very happy way to begin.
Mm-mm.
And the next step, I think, was another one of those army trips in the middle of the night by bus to Travis.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really not a great distance from the Oakland area. And more, there's same thing, nobody told us what was going to take place. All of a sudden we were flying into Alaska. And I remember the big peaks of Alaska being very different than the mountains of California. That kind of build up from rolling foothills to ridges. Alaska peaks were pretty much like these giant mountains. Quick vertical climb or steep slope. And stayed a little bit of time at Anchorage, I think, and then did the long trip across the pond, Pacific Ocean. And I do remember flying over Mount Fuji, which is interesting. I can't recall a lot of conversation between people. And finally arriving, I guess it was at Benoit. I know the people said that what struck them first is the heat. I can't say that triggers any memory. What triggers a memory is a different odor in the air. Very distinct, very clearly remember that. I think we did some more waiting time. Either Benoit or Long Ben, I'm not sure. I remember somebody coming down for us to get our Vietnam gear, clothing, steel pot or whatever it was. And then I remember a fuzzy area in there, and all I can remember is that eventually we got into a C-130 and did the flight up north to Da Nang. At some point, I remember seeing a couple, maybe it was two grunts, with boonie caps, boonie hats, and pretty dirty at some airport, and feeling like, well, those guys are different. And I remember standing in line and asking this big black guy what the emblem on his clothing was, and it turned out to be he just said Pathfinders. And that's an emblem that has stuck in my mind, although I didn't investigate it until this year. And how I got to the boats, I have no idea, but I will say that in between the C-130 flight and the actual boat, there was a long stop at a replacement company.
Mm-hmm.
Some more waiting around, doing nothing. And somebody spread the word that there had been a stabbing. One soldier stabbed another, or maybe it was two, in a bunk. So that's some more negativity that starts to set in.
Did you get any briefings when you were first arriving in country? As far as, you know, interacting with the Vietnamese people, that kind of stuff?
No, not that I recall. There was no briefing at any point, starting with Oakland.
Okay.
Army Depot is just, I guess somebody just showed up and said, okay, stay here. And somebody said, come on. But in between stay here and come on, there was a lot of waiting around doing nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't, I don't think I very well about that.
Mm-hmm.
Not at all to this day. And that somebody stabbing somebody in the bunks and all that. Anyway, I did report to the company. How I got there, I can't recall.
Where was your first assignment? When you say you reported into the company?
The company was based in Da Nang. And, however, our riverboats were stationed miles down the road from the main headquarters company,
mm-hmm.
from the company proper. Our boats were actually tied up next to a compound miles away,
mm-hmm.
and we could see that in that compound it was some kind of grunt or combat arms outfit. And we actually spent more time visiting their place, that compound, being near them, 100 feet away, or whenever we needed something like to go to their little miniature PX or NC or EM club for a beer or two, or a haircut. We went to that combat arms compound. We never went to ours. So from the time that I first reported to our company proper until leaving, I think I visited my company proper about three times. So when we weren't tied up at the pier where our boats were, near the grunt compound, and if we weren't there, we were going up the South China Sea or down it, and then to places like the Qua Viet River, most of the time, and then a few times down the Perfume, a few times. South to Chulai, and once to an island off the coast where we took some Coast Guard guys. Basically, it was all on the boat, seldom at our company proper, and times where I would consider that grunt compound as our compound, really.
Okay. What were you told when you arrived in the company would be your primary responsibility in this unit? What would you be doing?
I don't think we were told anything.
Oh, okay.
I think I saw the company commander 2 times
mm-hmm.
out of a tour of duty.
Mm-hmm.
First time is questionable whether he gave me any kind of hello speech. I'm uncertain about that. Second time was when we took one company commander. I don't know if it was the same one that was there when I started. On the boat on some trip.
Okay.
And it's kind of a theme that runs throughout this whole Army thing is that kind of the absence of involvement of the officers. And it kind of pleased me to see that on that one trip that we took the company commander on, for some reason, our warrant officer kind of talked down to him very negatively. And I kind of admire that for some reason. He didn't make the run the rivers like us. So there wasn't any indoctrination.
Okay. And when you received your assignment, was it to a platoon or to a specific boat, or were they one and the same?
To a specific boat.
Okay.
There was this little shed, I believe, that was in between that grunt compound and the boats that were on the pier. I believe that we did some had some conversation with the NCOs that were at that shed, probably did some paperwork. And I remember that they were collecting money to have a memorial built for one of the boats that did not come back. I guess all the crew was lost in the South China Sea someplace. So they were collecting monies, and they said that they were going to build a memorial back at Fort Eustis. The last year I called, and nothing got built.
Mm.
They just pocketed the money, I guess.
Mm.
Well, after that bad little scenario, I did report to my boat, and E5, or Buck Sergeant, soldier, just kind of introduced me around, showed me where my bunk was, and that was kind of a shock because, you see, if I had a little bit of good AIT training, I would have seen how small and cramped the living quarters actually was.
Mm-hmm.
I could say that I had a bunk, but for about 6 of us, the whole living area, bunk area, was about the size of a small prison cell. And that was a little bit of a shock. I got introduced around to some of the crew, and the skipper or the warrant officer. And my next recollection was of being out of strip and being assigned to a 50 caliber, which I had no training in, and a paratrooper by the name of Red showed me how to strip it down and assemble it. I guess my next memory would be of actually making the trip up the South China Sea and down the Kwaviat River. And this is another area where I think it would have helped if, during that little introduction by the warrant officer, if he would have said, okay, this is what we do. We're part of a counteroffensive number 5 or whatever it is, and we have to we're here to resupply by water the troops up along the DMZ. And we know that certain infantry operations are taking place, and we're part of that counteroffensive. But no such summary was given to me. I had no idea what was taking place, how long this counteroffensive would be, this unnamed trip to the Quaviet River. First thing I know is that some GI says he wants some anti-seasickness pill, and I said I refused it. And it happened to be a stormy day, and I got very seasick for about a full day. Mm-hmm. I wasn't ready for that at all. And the next thing I knew is I was behind a 50 caliber doing the Quaviet River thing. Mm-hmm. They called it the Dong Ho Run. But it would have helped if that foreign officer said, you know, this is what we do. This is what it's called, and this is why it's important. Mm-hmm. And you're not going to get very much sleep for a while. And he really didn't say much.
Now, how many men were on the boat with you?
I'd say about 11.
Okay.
There were two warrant officers. One was the actual skipper. The other was a transplant from the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
I guess at the time of all this Vietnam stuff, the Army did a call to the Navy and got some people that transferred from their NCO class into the warrant officer class.
Mm-hmm.
So ours was from the Navy, and I think he had some submarine background. And an E-5, a couple of people who were engine mechanics. The rest, we had one cook for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest were just soldiers, kind of a mixed bag. People from infantry background, paratroop, artillery.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, we acquired another guy from infantry, the Big Red One. They took him out of the field for some reason, and they stuck him on the boat. He developed chronic seasickness, and they still kept him on the boat. He just never got over the seasickness. So a guy didn't fit out of the field, and he didn't fit with us.
Now, what would he do if he was constantly sick on board?
I don't know. I didn't look into that. I didn't ask about it. A lot of the people were kind of a mystery through the whole thing.
And the cook, did this boat have a galley?
Yes. When you're gone 24 hours a day, you don't stop for brown bag lunches, 15 minutes up the coast at some army place. So I had to have a galley. And the guy that I mentioned who volunteered for Vietnam to get out of Fort Lewis, he was a cook that he became a cook at Fort Lewis, pretty much OJT. His name is Edward. He grew up in Nebraska. And he was good, but I was only with him for about a couple of months. But I always remember a scene where I was just amazed, because he was a good cook, but when it came time to go down the Quaviet River, put a steel pot on, flak jacket, grab an M60 to do your water mine thing, water mine hunting on the bow, he didn't have to, but he did it. And I really, that scene kind of always stuck with me. And I've had email contact with him in the last year.
Mm-hmm.
And of all the people that I've served with, I'm glad he's the only one I've had email contact with.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of them, I could care less what happened to them. We get around crews that you can't get away from. You live in a quarters the size of a prison cell. And one of them talks about mutiny, murder, and you're constantly at each other's throats. I mean, I added my negativity to it, but not to the point where, you know, mutiny and murder.
Mm-hmm.
I saw some idiot pull a bayonet on somebody else just to have that bayonet taken away by the sergeant, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
It was that kind of thing. You know, that kind of thing just got to me. Yeah, to this day, I think it's had an effect. And as dysfunctional as my family life as a boy was, I just wasn't ready for mutiny and murder and bayonet being pulled. That was the interaction and downside of the interactions.
Mm-hmm.
There was actually some good moments, too.
Well, let me ask you a couple of quick questions. What was the first mission you went out on?
It was up the South China Sea to doing this thing called Dong Hao Run.
Mm-hmm.
The first mission was, I don't know if I'd call it a mission. It was just our routine, taking ammunition or artillery rounds or black powder rounds up to the guys up along near the DMZ. I understand the Navy used to do that for the Marines, but since the Navy and the Marines had gone, it was pretty much up to us. And I'd like to say this, that at no time did I see one Republic of South Vietnam boat do what we did. None. I saw no Republic of South Vietnam boat take cargo, mm-hmm. ammunition. It was just us, our company, one company of boats. There was no Vietnamese patrolling the coast that I could see. And sometimes at night, after we had been docked up at Dong Ha, if it got too dark, the minesweepers that were manned by Vietnamese would leave on us.
Hmm.
Which means we were stuck at Dong Ha ammo dump. Either stay there or make it out unescorted by a minesweeper at night. And that happened a few times. In fact, one of the Navy personnel, one of the few Navy people that was there, told one of our warrant officers, I wonder what side those guys are on.
Hmm.
So that, my first mission was to down the Quaviet River to Dong Ha.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say it went like that, night and day, for about 4 months, with a few trips down to Chu Lai, and I think there was a place called Tan Mai that was near the Perfume River.
Mm-hmm.
At the mouth of that river, where we made a whole bunch of trips.
Okay.
But I guess the important push was the Dong Ha runs the Quaviet River,
mm-hmm.
which I only found out this year that was part of a counteroffensive.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you encounter a lot of enemy along the rivers, along the banks of the rivers? That is, did you get attacked often, or?
Okay, let's see how I put this. I encountered enemy on our boat.
Okay.
Our own guys.
Well, I mean,
okay,
Vietnamese.
I know that. I know what you're getting at. Let me make this point. Even though I had a 50 assigned to me,
mm-hmm.
and we did this thing with the M16s, back to 45 now and then. At no time did I engage in smaller arms fire. I was not shot at,
mm-hmm.
nor did I shoot.
Okay.
But quite ready to.
Mm-hmm.
All of our stuff, meaning the combat type of thing, was strictly incoming. Like being stuck at Dong Ha at night when the Vietnamese minesweepers had split on us. It'd be rockets. And off in the distance I could see these now and then. The memory of it's a little vague, but I think I remember seeing red and green tracer fire going back and forth at each other.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly it was rockets and mortars at these dumps, ammo dumps,
mm-hmm.
at Dong Ha, and even at the Da Nang ammo dump,
mm-hmm.
generally in the middle of the night, too.
Okay.
They sound pretty bad coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Sound like a freight train coming in at you. That's all I can tell you about that. I think I saw something go up in a huge ball of orange flame
mm-hmm.
on the Dong Ha at our ammo dump at Dong Ha. I was with Red, the paratrooper, that night. Now, what got hit, I don't know. All I know is my knees went weak.
Mm-hmm.
It embarrassed me.
Mm-hmm.
And I made sure that I didn't. I was more concerned about showing my weak knees than anything else. That was the kind of incoming I got, rockets and mortars.
Mm-hmm.
And I only saw, even though we went down a river that was mined, apparently, I only saw one that blew up.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the rare Vietnamese swift boats.
Mm.
I think they detonated it, and I just remember the chief, the skipper, saying, they got one. You know, kind of a cheer. And I look, and I see it rise to its apex. So I know the river was mined, because I saw that, and I also know that it was mined because I saw this tugboat that got hit, or it hit a water mine, and most of it was submerged, and a few of the bodies that they recovered were draped on the banks, a couple dead guys. They were stretched out, draped with canvas on the banks. I'd imagine the other guys were stuck in the boat. The odd thing over there was that there were kids playing around the bodies. So, that's it.
Okay.
Well, I would say that as far as my company headquarters proper goes, that while I was waiting for R&R to Hong Kong, seems like there's about two nights of just constant mortaring coming in, rolling in close to us. And so even those boys didn't have it absolutely peaceful. They also had a bad race riot there, from what I understand.
Okay. How was the racial makeup on your boat, and how did you guys get along in terms of race? You mentioned a story where, I guess, someone on your boat called another gentleman a not too flattering name and got his jaw broken, I guess.
Well, what happened? He wasn't on our boat.
Oh, okay.
Well, the company of boats, I don't know how many boats there were, maybe six? Yeah, there's probably about six boats.
Okay.
Each hold about 11 people. One of our engine room guys, was the only black guy in the whole company of boats,
mm-hmm.
as far as I know. Guy from Florida. There was another guy, a boat that had a fellow from Puerto Rico. I think from what I didn't see it happen, but
okay.
I guess the Puerto Rican guy called black guy the big N-word,
mm-hmm.
and ended up getting a little bit of R&R in the hospital with his jaw wired up.
Mm-hmm.
He later admitted he's not.
Okay.
I'd like to say that that same black guy,
mm-hmm.
Moreland, in fact, his name was Moreland, Moreland, while we were out in Damang Harbor, I think, or Bay, we had to do some kind of man overboard training. He and I went in the water to rescue this dummy person overboard.
Mm-hmm.
And I got caught in the current. He was towing me under. And it's just too much for me to fight. And I got pulled down once underneath the water, underneath the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew I was in trouble. And I came up. And got pulled down again. I knew I was going to die. I mean, I just couldn't believe it. And it's kind of like, oh, no, it's really happening. I can't get out of it. There's no way to get out of this. I'm going to die. So I come up the second time, luckily. I don't know why or how. And I hear Moreland say, this guy's drowning. Throw him something. Maybe I went down a third time, I don't know. Anyway, I came up and he says, you know, grab onto my leg. Had he not said that, I just would have gone over another, gone under again, probably final.
Mm.
You know, like the classic three times and you're out.
Mm-hmm.
So, had he not said that, you know, I don't think I would have lived through that little exercise.
Well.
So with his prompting, I did that. I grabbed his leg, and they pulled me on board. He did.
Mm-hmm.
And all the guys did was whistle that music of somebody dying, you know, pray for the dead, and dead will pray for you.
Mm-hmm.
They just kind of made a joke of it, and I asked him, what does it look like? And one of them said, like somebody drowning.
Well.
So Marlon was the only black guy, and I pretty much think he saved my life.
Mm-hmm.
There was a few Latinos. One was a transplant from some South American or Central American country.
Mm-hmm.
One guy was from Puerto Rico, but a New Yorker. A few people from the South, deep South. The guy that wanted us to mutiny and murder was from the Deep South.
Mm-hmm.
I believe the warrant officer, the skipper, was from Kentucky. The Navy transplant, who was the engine room guy, I think he was from Texas. And then we acquired here and there a few of the combat arms NCOs. Where they're from, I don't know. I do know that one reported for duty. He was infantry, then he was MP, and he was just kind of closing out his career, and he had this ambition of going to run some kind of fishing boat up in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And this was his way of getting some training.
Okay. Well,
that's another place we got hit. It is the name. Demand ammo down for the rockets would come in because there's ammunition there.
Mm-hmm.
And the odd thing is sometimes from a distance I'd hear about it and I'd get nervous.
Mm-hmm.
But other times I'd be right there. And I could hear them coming in like freight trains and it didn't bother me a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd look around and see these little surrealistic scenes of some Vietnamese running around kind of like in slow motion under that dim light. Strange thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't you go ahead and discuss, if you would, why this member of your boat wanted to you all to mutiny and kill the warrant officer.
God. Well, I guess he just kept us on the go all the time. It was just nonstop, basically. Oh, we had a few little excursions, like he'd take us to some secluded part of Da Nang Bay and let us have a little beer and swimming party. And I hate to admit this, but a couple times he brought on some Vietnamese whores. And, you know, there's just Vietnamese whores all in the galley cooking hard-boiled eggs and cackling away. And there's a couple things like that that he allowed us to do. But basically, they kept us on the go all the time, up the coast or down the coast. There was just no rest period. And he's kind of like a guy that Humphrey Bogart played. I mean, he was competent and all that, but there was just no break. There was no break. There was never any explanation why this whole operation was important. Just constantly being awake, and you're awake from 12 to 3 or 12 to 4, and then you can't sleep because it's too hot. You're awake for the rest of the day, and then that night you go from 4 to 8 in the morning watch. And these watches, these night watches, you're constantly throwing concussion grenades in the water, you know, keep VC frogmen, so to speak, or sappers from doing things wrong to you. So they're throwing these concussion grenades and launching flares pretty much all night. And while you're awake, which is most of the time, you're doing little things to keep this little boat clean, like buffing the floor, just like stateside, which you wanted to get away from. Or shining brass, and things like that. And not leaving one little rust stain. So I guess it all adds up to that one person wanting to talk us into mutiny and murder. And he didn't want us to do it. He didn't propose that. He didn't say, let's go get a fragmentation grenade. And we had all kinds of grenades. Concussion, fragmentation, M16s up the kazoo. All right, we could have done it. They wanted us to hire these Vietnamese thugs they called cowboys to do it. That was kind of an eye-opener. I don't know. I guess I took them seriously. But nothing ever happened. And there was no joking around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he meant it.
Yeah. No one turned him in?
No.
Do you know if the warrant officer ever caught wind of it?
Excuse me?
Do you know if the warrant officer ever caught wind of it?
I don't think so. Nah, he pretty much kept to himself,
mm-hmm.
or kept us going. As far as I know, all the warrant officers got bronze stars, meritorious type,
mm-hmm.
and we got nothing. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that this mutiny murder guy did that kind of was interesting. He made when the warrant officer came back there. The bronze stars from merit. He showed them to us, and that mutiny murder guy went up and said, "I'm gonna go up top and polish my metal."
Hmm.
It was a way of kind of, you know, mocking him.
Mm-hmm.
He could have done better to inform us what was going on. And, you know, done a few things to make it easier, but. Certainly didn't deserve talk of mutiny and murder.
Mm-hmm. Now, did...
And when I came home, mm-hmm. I tell you, after that kind of thing, sleep deprivation and then that kind of murder mutiny talk and somebody pulling a bayonet out on somebody else. And my brother's, half-brother's girlfriend says, "You've changed." Well, hell yes. And the guy that I mentioned, he pulled a bayonet on somebody. He's the same guy I heard who, during this during one moment on the bow where on the Quaviet River, where you have an M16, looking for mines, that skipper, warrant officer, said something to him. Mr. Bayonet Puller Outer turned around and pointed the M16 at him. That's what I heard.
So. Anything happened to him?
No.
Was was
I'd
there
like
any
to
other
say one thing here that I remember I replaced this southern guy on the bow. It was my turn to take the bow on the Quaviet.
Uh-huh.
It just so happened that he put his M16 down to rest upon some rail, and it flopped in the Quaviet. Plunk.
Mm-hmm.
And that warrant officer was going to charge him for the weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Money.
Mm-hmm.
And here they are. We were handing over tanks and helicopters, tons of machine guns to the Vietnamese, and this guy wants to charge them. I didn't think that was right.
Mm-hmm.
Your question?
I was just curious if there were any other threats that you were aware of made to officers or warrant officers or NCOs.
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
We were pretty much stuck on that one boat.
Yeah.
I mean, I could say we were part of a company of boats, but when in reality, it was just us.
Well, I'm just, and I'm just interested in what happened on your particular boat. What about that fight that you said where the guy pulled the bayonet out on another guy? What was that about? And that was on your boat, correct?
Yeah. I don't know. I can't remember. It was in the cruise quarters.
Mm-hmm.
I remember these pretty cramped things.
Mm-hmm.
All I know is a guy was on the bottom bunk, and I just see a bayonet being pulled against the second in command of the crew, who was a name was Bill. His buck sergeant, and Bill just grabbed the thing and. You want to use this? You want to use this?
Mm-hmm.
And just reverse the whole thing. And I just remember that. What it was about, I don't know.
Mm.
It didn't take much.
Yeah.
Like I said, my attitude at times didn't help, but it didn't get like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now,
I'd like to say one other thing, though.
Please.
I mentioned being at our company proper is a place for a couple of nights of mortars coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to R&R in Hong Kong, and some things there I ought to skip. I had a pretty good time, and I did not want to report to the riverboats again. And I talked to the company commander. Maybe it was the second time I ever saw him. And I said, I wanted a job there at the company. Quarters. But I ended up reporting back tattoo. And for punishment, the chief warrant officer made me paint the arms room. It's a little cell size room by the engines.
Mm-hmm.
And that engine room gets hot. And what it meant was I'd have to take one wall of 50 caliber crates down,
mm-hmm.
a huge stack, relocate them in this hot, noisy place,
mm-hmm.
and paint that surface, do the same to another wall, and so on, and so on, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And it just dawned on me last year, or this year, he wasn't interested in punishing me for going outside of the chain of command. He was interested in having his arms room painted.
Mm-hmm.
I really believe that's the intent.
Mm-hmm.
I just had to have a little spick and span boat.
Hmm. The units that you supported in terms of your resupply missions, were they almost exclusively American Army, or were they combinations Army, Marine Corps, Vietnamese, other country forces?
As far as I know, American Marines had left the area.
Okay.
as I know, it was strictly American Army. It didn't, we didn't really talk to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Even when we went to that grunt compound where in Da Nang, you know, there was no, hey, where are you guys from?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was just come on in, go out.
Okay.
When we went to the ammo dumps on the Perfume or Quaviet River, we didn't talk to anybody, and we really didn't get off the boat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, drop your stuff and hang around, head back, unless you get stuck overnight because some minesweepers leave you.
Mm-hmm.
I will say that we did pick up one mechanized unit once. I'm not quite sure where it was. They came on board with their APCs and their M16s with banana clips. And I kind of liked those guys. We did talk to them, from what I remember.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to brag about our little ammo dumps and rockets and all that.
Mm-hmm.
At, they impressed me with the banana clips and dirt.
And how many APCs
could you... Glad to help them out.
Mm-hmm. How many APCs could you fit on your boat?
I can't remember, maybe two.
Okay.
Which is another thing we did. We did, it wasn't strictly ammo, but now and then we'd take back, shall we say, ruined tanks.
Mm-hmm.
Took back more than one. We took back quite a few.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask me how they were ruined, I can't remember. I just remember taking extra precautions and securing down these huge tanks. Shipping them back.
Mm-hmm. And
and we never did, like the grunts like to say, you know, they like to say, oh, well, without you, we wouldn't have the beans and bullets.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't that easy. It was never beans.
Mm-hmm. And you would, so you would be able to transport quite a bit of material out there to the field in terms of ammunition then?
In terms of ammunition, yes. And it was mainly M16 and artillery rounds.
Mm-hmm.
And a number of times it was just black powder cartridges.
Mm.
I guess at that point where it's just black powder cartridges, things could get pretty volatile quickly.
Mm-hmm.
If you weren't careful.
Okay.
You know, a lot of this stuff that I'm, reason I'm after 30 years, I really haven't really talked about this,
mm-hmm.
not even to my, you know, wife or kid,
mm-hmm.
or anybody.
Okay.
Kind of been wondering what I'd tell my girl about my whole life. And so this is kind of helpful because it includes a childhood. Maybe I'll just hand over things to her.
Mm-hmm. Well, is there anything else you want to talk about with regard to your time in Vietnam?
One thing, I just, my father, I mentioned he was an immigrant from the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
It's not my time in the country, but prior to leaving, I did make one visit to him. And he never became a citizen, never did learn to read or write English.
Mm-hmm.
And so he took me to this Chinese place in Stockton, California, where all the old Filipinos used to hang around. And he told his Chinese waiter, this is my son. He goes to Korea, I mean Vietnam. And that's the word Vietnam, I go to Korea, I mean Vietnam, is just about the only thing that I remember, you know, him saying about Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And in all 30 years that since, and in the time that I've had conversations with my wife, all I do is say Korea, I mean Vietnam. That phrase is something that I have fun with.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to put that in.
Yeah. Did you get a chance to go to the Philippines?
No.
While you were in Southeast Asia?
No, and I never want to see Southeast Asia again.
Okay.
Head that direction, never.
Okay. All right. So is there anything else you'd like to talk about with regard to your time in Vietnam?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Now,
well, let me say that there were a couple of good points. I mean, there were times where I must say that coming into Da Nang Harbor, when the sun was going down, standing on the bow of that flat-bottomed boat, it just kind of a feeling of being of adventure, of power, of being natural, and of doing something adventurous. That came over me, and it struck me that seeing all these poor people, this mama-san on a sampan with a boat, with a grandson sitting there for hours and hours, just holding out her hand, begging. These are images that are important. And one of the thing that I regret is I joined in with a couple of GIs and took a couple grenades and threw them at the water's edge where some kids were, you know, sticking out their hands at us. You know, try to plunk them right next to them, but not on them. I regret that. And that kind of scene, the scene of a lot of South Vietnamese that seem to be missing a limb or two limbs, South Vietnamese men. And going into a place that I just recently found out that it was called Dog Patch. It was a shanty town. We weren't supposed to be there. But now and then we'd slip through this fence and go off and, you know, do things the young GIs are going to do. And I remember seeing a house made out of, with walls on it, with a container, cardboard or plywood marking, cardboard or plywood container box material with Coca-Cola on it. And that was the interior of the wall. And this former Arvin paratrooper pointing a flashlight at my crotch, kicked it in his hand. He told me I wasn't going to get out of the villa alive. Now, these kinds of images are interesting. And they never let us into Da Nang proper. That was across the bay, except for two times. They let us in by ferry boat. Other than that, it was just images of the sun coming up and watching these people do these exercises in the rising sun, which I know now those exercises are Tai Chi. It's very interesting to watch them move like that. And it was one trip, one of the two times we got into Da Nang proper, I remember having Vietnamese, dinner at a Vietnamese restaurant, and some little girl, cutest little girl, begging for money at the window. And I always remember that kind of a face. But all grown up now. That's about it. And this year that I learned that there are places, big bases where they had swimming pools and biggie birders and bowling alleys. You know, I had it better than the grunts, but not that good. Have biggie burgers and swimming pools. But I'm glad I didn't go to a place or stay in a place with a swimming pool. I think I wasn't grunt or helicopter pilot, but what I did was right for me. I think I was kind of person that the riverboats needed. Whether the riverboats ended up like, didn't end up like the Sand Pebbles movie, or it doesn't matter.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. You know, having that image in your mind and then having that experience, was it at all disillusioning as you were experiencing Vietnam and it didn't really match up with what you had, I guess, thought it might be?
Well, I still love the movie.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I got a copy of it and I still love it. Mm-hmm. That's okay if it's disillusioning. Yeah, I was a kid when I fell in love with that movie.
Right.
I ain't got a problem.
Okay. Well,
our skipper or chief never told us about what we were supporting,
mm-hmm.
all those trips down the Quaviet.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, I'm just, you know, regardless of what my motives were of leaving stateside duty or what was going on with the politics of people negotiating the end of that war like a union management contract,
mm-hmm.
I'm glad I served, the grunts up on the DMZ and the Perfume River area.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel that you had accomplished very much when you left?
At the time that I left, no, I just kind of had a feeling of despair, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a little bit rough being locked up in a floating cell.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, there were good moments of standing on the bow of coming into Da Nang and being lean and, you know,
mm-hmm.
and brown and adventurous,
mm-hmm.
but the things like the bayonet and being up all night and doing the job for the Vietnamese and being around somebody who wants to mutiny and murder, I had a feeling of despair. A little change came over.
Mm-hmm.
But at this point, I feel pretty good about it.
Mm-hmm. What was it like when you got back to the United States?
Culture shock.
Mm-hmm.
Very much. I mean, you go from... Remember, I wasn't on sprawling bases with swimming pools,
mm-hmm.
and movie theaters. Mm-hmm. I was, rivers and stuff like that. I do remember my half-brother's girlfriend driving down a regular American highway and just being overwhelmed by it. Before I get to that point, I'd like to say that when we got into, when we finally got over here,
mm-hmm.
to the United States, it was Fort Lewis, in fact. Mm-hmm. There wasn't anybody spitting at me. I don't call them baby killer. I don't know why people keep repeating that.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine there was very, very little of that. There was just one photographer that was taking welcome home pictures for money.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a little bit irritated by that. You know, it wasn't like we're getting back from Hawaii. You know, welcome home. You know. So he was doing that for money.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't like that.
Okay. But you didn't encounter interwar protesters?
Or? Oh, hell no.
Okay.
I think a lot of that was exaggerated. They just kind of gave us a little speech. You know, this is what's been going on in the time you've been gone.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus freaks, bicycles are in, do-do-do. And they led us to some NCO led us to barracks,
mm-hmm.
into barracks. And they just left us alone again.
Mm-hmm.
And talked to us. And I remember they did give us a steak dinner, kind of a welcome home steak dinner, and I shared it with this guy who had the emblem of the Signal Corps on him, on his khakis. And we didn't talk much about Vietnam, but I always remember the Signal Corps because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And when they gave the officers, one of the few times I've saw officers is... they tried to, you know, give us the last chance to re-up.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody took it.
Mm-hmm.
They gave us these Westmoreland certificates, you know, a grateful nation during difficult time, and one by form letter, where they call those mass-produced things, by Richard Nixon. Threw all those away. And they did not tell us that we had unemployment compensation coming to us. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
A little money to buy time to figure things out.
Yeah.
Now, maybe we're all stupid and should have figured that out, but after being 2 years or more in the Army, things are just supposed to be presented to you. You have to be explained about how the real world works.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did not know I had unemployment coming to me to buy time to sort things out. I ended up back in California and stayed for a little bit at my brother and his girlfriend's house, apartment, half brother. But started really thinking about what next.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the option, the idea. Well, I know, you know, guns. I'll be a security guard, and that didn't happen. I only jolted once from the sound of a big noise. And I remember sitting there having dinner, and somebody up in the apartment upstairs dropped something. And just kind of, you know, reacted to that a little bit. People around me said, "What's going on?" Nothing. But after that, I thought, I mentioned that I wasn't at prior to going into the Army. I really wasn't all that happy with college,
mm-hmm.
and I still felt that way. But this place called Lawrence Livermore Lab had just put down a national lab,
mm-hmm.
had what they called a demand occupational training program. That's for training minorities and people like that in a demand occupation, vocational training.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, I can make a little income and learn a skill.
Mm-hmm.
They pretty much, it was a one-year program, and they pretty much were like the officers. They just gave us things to do, a little bit of showed us how to do a little bit. But what they did not match their fancy certificate at the end of the year that said phase one was X number of hours of classroom training, phase two was demonstration of shop tools, phase three was more classroom training, basic mathematics. It didn't work out that way. It was just cheap labor.
Hmm.
And I guess at that point, I decided to become serious about college. So although it was useless, and even another person, Japanese guy, told him it was useless, both that Japanese guy and myself had forced us into taking up formal college rather than relying upon that kind of farce
mm-hmm.
training program.
Okay. What did you think when the war ended in 75? Well, technically, we pulled out in 73, and then North Vietnam invaded South Vietnam in 75.
I guess my immediate feelings was, well, it didn't take too damn long for them to retake it. Seemed like such a waste. I guess right now I don't want. Seems like such a unique time that it shouldn't be forgotten. It
mm-hmm.
shouldn't be forgotten in the context of the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
And Korea shouldn't either. And I feel that, and I don't know much about politics or history, but I feel like in some way, perhaps Vietnam and Korea helped diffuse or put those crazy political ideas and disperse the little crazinesses all over the place. place rather than have a direct nuclear confrontation. Perhaps it dissipated some of that BS that was going on and throughout the world, and maybe we avoided nuclear war because of that. That's whether or not victory in Vietnam on a, you know, on our side, whether that's important or not, according to my theory, I don't know. But perhaps we dissipated some of that same almost gone nuclear war, Cold War period. Now, I could care less about Vietnam. Yeah. And I'm a little bit bitter that the Vietnamese did not do anything like we did, taking ammunition up north. I think I only saw a patrol boat here and there now and then on the Qua Viet at night. Mm-hmm. And I don't feel particularly great about the scarcity of that scene. Nor do I feel good about the Vietnamese that were on that minesweep that left us at night. Nor do I feel good about my first real encounter with a Vietnamese at that grunt compound. She was operating some kind of concession stand where you could buy sandwiches or something. And phonetically, I asked her what she had, you know. And she just looked at me, kind of, just didn't hardly look at me, just passed me. And kind of a monotone, said, ham and chi, bologna, chi, salami, chi. And I guess it registered, you know, because this is, they're not with this war. You know, they're just mannequins. I don't know if I answered anything for you.
Yeah. Well, what do you think about the normalizing of relations with Vietnam now?
I don't feel good about that. I don't think I could ever like that country in any of its political forms.
Okay.
And I don't feel good about those minesweepers leaving us or not doing anything that we did. They didn't go through sleep deprivation.
Okay.
They acquired a whole bunch of Navy and Coast Guard Swift boats.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just tied up in the port in Da Nang.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that.
Mm. Okay. All right, so this will end CD number one of the interview with Bob Garcia, Robert Garcia, on the 26th of March. This is Steve Maxner continuing the interview with Bo Garcia on the 26th of March, 2001, at about 3:30 p.m. Lubbock time. Sir, I was curious, after you got back and after the fall of Saigon, did you talk much about Vietnam with anybody?
No, never. Well, during that training program,
mm-hmm.
there was a Chicano soldier, veteran, Paco, the nickname I gave him. We just mentioned it briefly. I've mentioned it to a couple of intimates, but never have I gone on like this conversation here. I use my father's phrase, Korea, I mean Vietnam, to my wife, but I've really, really never talked to her about it, nor my daughter. Has occasionally seen something on History Channel and said, you know, asked me about it a little bit,
mm-hmm.
and I just give a word or two response and let it go.
Mm-hmm.
However, on the internet, I have finally had some conversations with other veterans, primarily grunts, in which I've gone into a little bit more detail. Of course, hold back as they hold back. But up until this year, no, I haven't really said anything. I have conversed with my friend at work who volunteered, was a paratrooper. Artilleryman is what he ended up doing in Vietnam, and not really too much out in the field from what I gather. I guess he was on some kind of base where he coordinated fire. Yeah. So he wasn't really out in some mountain loading up artillery guns with shells. It was pretty much something else. Mm-hmm. He and I have touched base now and then, more so than I've ever touched base with anybody. And another co-worker who's gone, who's retired, I touched base with him a little bit. Mm-hmm. But there really hasn't been any conversation.
And what would you...
Maybe if I was a grunt, I'd be talking to everybody's ears off. I don't know.
Well, when you got back, did it seem like anybody wanted to talk about it?
No.
Okay.
I guess the war ended before it ended. Mm-hmm. And people lost interest. Mm-hmm. And by 71, I guess they could care less what was taking place.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, that family, the HB, when they never brought it up.
Mm-hmm.
I even asked, do you even know where I was at? And he says, yeah, you're kind of got this grin. Yeah, you're in the Mekong. No, I was farther, way farther north than that.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, there is pretty much indifference. Life goes on.
Mm-hmm.
And it pretty much stayed that way.
Okay. Did you?
I hope young people get a little bit of an introduction to it.
Mm-hmm. Was there anything in particular that was important concerning your experience in Vietnam that you took away from it, and is that just an important thing for you in your life?
Probably. Well, I've had good and bad experience prior to mm-hmm. and following Vietnam. I would suppose it didn't make me more of a man, but I think it gave me just a little bit more endurance, a willingness to endure just about anything. I think that's important.
Yeah.
It's been very important, that aspect. Of course, it did shift my personality about a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I did acquire a little bit of an attitude. And perhaps a little bit of a sense of superiority
mm-hmm.
for those that have not even come close to that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Is there something in particular you would want your daughter to know about your service and how it was important to you? And
well, there are some specifics that I have really wrestled with in telling her about. And if I show her those transcripts, I guess I won't have to wrestle with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Skipper bringing in whores and all that kind of thing, and somebody talking about mutiny and murder.
Mm-hmm.
She called me a hero once. I don't know why. Maybe Vietnam was part of it. Maybe it's just because I'm her father.
Mm-hmm.
I dismissed that hero bit. But if I wanted to tell her anything, it would be to things aren't what she think they are what they're made out to be. Mm-hmm. And you can endure, and you can keep going when you're tired. You know, just don't give up. Mm-hmm. That's what I have to say to her. And possibly my theory about the Cold War and our part in avoiding possible nuclear war. Mm-hmm. That maybe we contributed to the longevity of this world. That's just a dumb theory, but that's the best I can come up with.
Okay.
That's about it.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you wanted to discuss certain aspects about being multi-ethnic.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know if you wanted to go ahead and address that issue real quick.
Well, let me say this. This year, when I was in Vietnam, it's one occasion where I kept on hearing, it was, I don't know, some night there was a red alert, which means something was taking place, and we're supposed to get our steel pots on and all that kind of thing. And I heard some Vietnamese on their radio doing their Vietnamese chatter, and I kept hearing one person kept saying, dink, 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 pause, shut up, dink, more denigrating things. And I remember looking at my warrant officer and saying, why don't you stop this? You'd stop us just as a matter of keeping radio discipline. Oh, I didn't hear that racist kind of thing kind of stuck in my head. You know, we didn't deal much with the Vietnamese. I didn't like that Vietnamese person at that concession thing, you know, just looking like a zombie. But I never called him Dink. And at first, on the net, I read where some of the veterans called them gooks and dinks and all that. At first it bothered me, but it doesn't anymore. I call myself a flip now on that, on the boards. Mexiflip. But I would say that a few years after I got back from Vietnam, I heard some racist comments made about minorities. I went back after. It was one of those fine line things that it could be interpreted either way, but really was racist. Several times after I got back from Vietnam, it wasn't right. I started to go after one guy, but my coworker said, just let it slip. Now, I do not hear any more of that kind of thing, except for a year ago some kid called my girl the brownie. It kind of, you know, bothered me at first, kind of like, oh no, it's happening all over again. But that was probably a little kid thing. But it is important for me now, and it's important for my wife now, when it comes to these silly forms that do not allow for the choice of other, or multiracial. And because my daughter is German, Filipina, Italian, and Mexican-American, fully American, and I do not like it for any statistical purposes or legal backup that she should be forced to choose one category over the other. For her to choose Hispanic is what they use, which sounds too European, over her German-Italian side, or Filipino over her German-Italian side is wrong. But I don't think I'm going to win that game for that, my little campaign in that area. Mm-hmm. Now, I certainly would like her to feel very positive about her European side,
mm-hmm.
and her Mexican Chicana side.
Mm-hmm. Does she have much contact with her other relatives? That is your, I guess, her, is your, I don't know if your father is still living.
No, he died a long time ago.
Okay. Or any other family members?
No, not really. That half-brother who's the biggest wannabe in the world, I pretty much cut it off with him, mm-hmm. and he never had any kids. Okay. And his full brother stayed in jail. Yeah, so...
Mm-hmm.
No, she doesn't have very much contact.
Yeah. Did you have much contact with your mother when you got back?
No, not too much.
Okay.
She's kind of gone off the deep end.
Okay.
And I don't know. Say that one person, I remember sending an email saying, look out for the wannabes.
Mm-hmm.
Without giving his name out directly, he's a lawyer and kind of is a good writer.
Mm-hmm.
Very good.
Mm-hmm.
He's people, literary people, have you know brought him to their universities. I see it all over the web.
Mm-hmm.
But I found his name in a military database, and I called up Fort Monmouth, which is the Signal Corps fort. And I said, what is this Vietnam era MOS? And they said, if I remember correctly, Tactical Microwave Systems Repair Specialist.
Mm-hmm.
It was high tech at the time, it was taught by civilians, it was lengthy, it was complicated. And I've checked with several colonels of the infantry, and I said, look, I've heard the proverbial stories about the, you know, technician that got slapped with a radio on his back, but do you really think that a tactical systems microwave repair specialist would be forced into the field and made into an RTO, as he claims? And I said, sounds bogus to me.
Hmm.
And I said, look, this guy is claiming that he was drafted at 15. Yeah, that's crap. I said, yep, that's crap. And this guy is claiming that he got overrun. He arrived in Vietnam and was taken to a telecommunications hilltop and got overrun by 3,500 North Vietnamese. And the grunts know that no such large operation took place while American air power was around.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't do anything in 3 days in Vietnam when you arrive. You get warehoused. Yeah, so I don't know what I'm saying there. Is that very same person who makes claim to being a hero to the downtrodden brown people. He was a very cruel person and has lied on a number of things, including military and including being a field worker, whereas I probably saw more junk in Vietnam than he did.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of scoffed at several times at my duty in Vietnam on the rivers. Yeah. Another way of putting me down. I've certainly spent more times at these old farm labor camps when I was a kid, but I never worked. Where am I going with this?
Don't know.
Refresh my memory.
I'm letting you go.
Oh, you are. Huh? Okay.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to discuss today?
I guess we all that last bit had to do with brownicity. Huh?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Why don't I go ahead and, if you don't have anything else you'd like to discuss today?
No, I don't think so.
Let me go ahead and just stop the recording. This will end the interview.